Okay, so it's day three. We're still settling in. It's funny how, you know, we're all just sitting quietly in a room. Everything is peaceful. You would imagine this shouldn't be hard. But it is. It is challenging. It is. And to stand up, to make a stand for, I guess, facing our own, like, personal emotional backlogged, you know, unprocessed baggage, you know, that takes courage. A lot of that baggage kind of, you know, comes up during these retreats. Difficult emotions can arise, frustration, anger, anxiety, fear. Most people will live their whole lives and never really face it. I don't know about Malaysia, but in Canada, a lot of times when you meet some acquaintance that you have not seen in a long time, and you ask, "Oh, I haven't seen you in a long time. How are you?" And they'll say, like, "Oh, busy, busy." You know, like, as though being busy is somehow good. I suppose making a living, well, that's important. We have to have a livelihood, sure. It is better than lazy. I'll agree with that, you know. But I think if we were more honest with ourselves, we would see that oftentimes this busyness is, it's an attempt to ignore unpleasant feelings we are experiencing. Whenever we have difficult things in our lives happen, I mean really difficult things, you know, really, really rough, you know, you hear really rough news, maybe a family member dies, or there's some, I don't know, some big scandal in the news. It's, you know, these days, there's a big scandal just about every day. Something, you know, really emotionally just really kind of jarring. And that all affects our hearts. That affects our emotions, whether we will admit that or not. And it's always accompanied with some bodily discomfort, which we might mindfully note, mindfully observe, or we might just not really want to feel that. And we kind of become numb, you know, numb to the pain. And then when we come to a meditation retreat like this, and then we practice mindfulness of the body or the breath, and then we, you know, find these numb places. We find numb places on our body. Hard to find, you know, we can't sense what's there. Sometimes we can't even find where that body part is. For the first several retreats that I did, I had one of these really difficult places that I just couldn't really feel it, which was in the center of my chest, right where my heart was. I could feel the front surface of my body, and I could feel the back surface too. But then when I tried to have awareness inside my torso, inside my chest, like where my heart is inside, I just couldn't really find where that was. My awareness did not want to go there. It was as though there was like, it's going to sound really weird, but it was as though there was almost like a force field pushing my awareness away from that spot. You know, I'd try to put my awareness there, and it was almost like an invisible force would throw it back away again. You know, I'd try to find it, no. I'd try to find it, no. It would be like pushed away. You know, I'd come from the other side. You know, can I come in from the back side? Nope, you'd push me out again. No matter how I tried to feel in my chest, I couldn't.
So in that case, when you talk to yourself, you sort of like tell, okay, I'm going there now, you know?
Well, yeah, a little bit of internal chatter, sure. Although I would encourage you to don't overuse that. Sometimes if the mind is very restless, a bit of that self-encouragement can cut through that chatter of the mind, you know? It can provide direction when we are really, you know, having some restlessness in the mind. It's difficult. But if we overuse it, the mind will never really settle down to peace. We want it totally quiet, if possible. Totally silent. Yeah, so if we too much inner chatter, that never comes. We want total quiet eventually, if we can get it. Yeah, so anyway, it took me years to really feel like I could feel that place in my chest. And once I finally could, that really brought a lot of more happiness to my practice and happiness to my life. I became a happier person, actually. It made a big difference. It's as though I needed to do that in order for my heart to gain more like warmth or gain more happiness. Yeah, it is as though that I had to do that. If you want to try a fun experiment, yeah, see if you can feel in the center of your chest, right in here, halfway between the front of your chest and the back, kind of inside your torso. So anyway, we will discover there are these kind of blank areas, numb areas. It's hard to feel it. And perhaps we were earlier on in our lives like repressing difficult issues. And this can come even from like when we were children or babies, or some would even say from past lives. This kind of stuff can still be, you know, this kind of baggage can come with you from a past life. So yeah, that's, it is surprisingly challenging to face these difficult things when we've been running away from it all this time. We've been kind of distracting ourselves all this time, being busy, busy all this time. And it feels extremely worthwhile to me to have done that work. It really is like a burden that one can put down. This need to always distract oneself and run away and desensitize oneself. We can lose touch with our hearts and lose touch with our emotions. And when we lose touch with that, we're probably going to lose touch with people around us too. If we're numb to our own emotions, come on, we're probably numb to other people's emotions too. Those two things kind of, you know, would go hand in hand. So by becoming better friends to ourselves, at that emotional level, that will help us in our relationships too, because we'll be able to open up more to others emotionally, you know, just to have emotional availability to others. One of the things I think is so cool about Malaysia is the odd time when I go hiking up some hill, about halfway up the hill, there'll be kind of like a little tea outpost. You know, it's got like a roof and it's open air, and there's a place to boil a kettle to make tea, and there's be like a table in there, and there's always like a few people in there drinking tea. That's so cool. I wish Canada had that. You know, it's sort of a place to meet up, and, you know, sometimes if strangers are there, you know, you might meet somebody new. That's the kind of neighborhood thing that I think is really important to have, and, you know, for people to just be comfortable with each other, even if they're strangers, and maybe they don't become friends or anything, but at least they're comfortable in the same space. That's worth a lot. There's a custom which some of the Westerners have and some don't, which is a bit like this. And it is the so-called Latin countries, like European countries. So this would be like Italy, Spain, you know, Portugal, France, all those European countries which share this Latin influence. They have this cool thing in their culture, which is a bit like your tea station halfway up the hill. It's the Spanish call it they call it this a sobremesa. I only learned this pretty recently, and that's their word for dessert. But what it really means is, like, once the family's done eating supper together, then they will just hang out around the table. They don't leave. And they make coffee and desserts are brought out. And this can go on for like 2 hours. And it's just a time of hanging out. Anybody can talk about anything. It's very chatty and talkative. They're drinking coffee. And like the neighbors can show up. You know, the neighbors just knock on the door because they know this is happening. You know, they come in, they sit down, serve them coffee. And it's like... And, you know, the kids are there, the parents are there, the aunties and uncles come, the grandmas are there, the old people are there, the young, you know, everybody comes, anybody comes. And it's just sort of the hangout time. And there's no real topic, there's no real agenda, they don't solve any problems or anything to speak of. It's more like just hanging out and drinking coffee. And if nobody says anything, that's okay. But there is this sense of easy emotional availability. Yeah, they do it in Brazil too. They have something like that in Brazil, too. Anyway, now the European countries that are not the Latin ones, so like the UK, Germany, etc., they don't have this custom. I wish they had this custom. So my family, our background is, I'm part German, part English, and we just don't have this, eh? I had no idea, you know, I had no idea what the Silver Mesa was until pretty recently. And I'm like, oh, I wish we had that. My younger sister, she married one of the French Canadians in Eastern Canada. And France has this custom. So his family does this, you know, and yeah, so they hang out, they drink coffee. The French do this. Anyway, I'm dwelling on this because Here we are in this retreat, and it's, you know, noble silence. We're not really talking to each other. It feels like a very private practice. You know, we almost might feel a little selfish because we're not, I don't know, engaged in some kind of a community-oriented type of service. You know, we're secluded away from our lives and our families and, you know, jobs and everything, our community. But I would argue, the more that we can open up to our own just through the object of meditation, we open up to sensitivity to our bodies, sensitivity to our breath, sensitivity to the room we're in, even to just feel comfortable with these people in the room. You know, you don't know them, maybe you don't know their names, you don't really know their story, you don't know what kind of life they live, really. You might guess. You might guess what kind of life they live, but you don't really know. It's tempting to make up stories about the people around, what they're like, but please don't do that. It's tempting to guess, but please don't. But anyway, all this sensitivity, I say, it does make us, I say, better people, because we become more sensitive to our own emotional state, even difficult emotions. And then having faced that and having, you might say, made peace with it, okay? We're making peace with these difficult emotions. We're making peace with our hearts. We're making peace with all this baggage that we brought with us, okay? And then when we go back to our families, back to our jobs or whatever at the end, now we have something to show for it. We will have more sensitivity. We will have better emotional availability, hopefully more emotional maturity even. That'd be great. And the more that we can bring mindfulness to our relationships, that will improve the relationships. And I have a challenge for you on this retreat. As you do your awareness of body, you know, make sure you can feel the front of your chest and the back of your torso. And then, yeah, see if you can feel in the middle of your chest. That's what I was talking about. Can you just find where that is? Where is its location? Can you just dwell with your awareness in there comfortably? And when you do that, you know, get really good at it. Do it lots. And then at the end of the retreat, when it's time to talk again, see if you can remain centered with your awareness in that place, and then speak in that state. Speak from that centered awareness in your chest. Like, hold on to that without losing it. Then speak while doing that. That's my challenge to you. It's hard to do. It's hard to do. But I would argue that someone who can do that is going to have way better right speech than someone who doesn't do that. I would say right speech becomes much easier. Much easier when we can learn to do that. It's like we're speaking from the heart. And I don't mean that in like a metaphorical way. Oh, speaking from the heart. Right. You know, I'll just intend to be more kind when I talk. That'll be my speaking from the heart. It's like, no. Actually dwell with your awareness in there and then speak. To my mind, that is speaking from the heart. That's my definition of actually speaking from the heart. Question?
Yes.
Okay, so I have a question about someone who, when they look inside their chest, it feels heavy, it feels tight, and there was a past angioplasty. Okay, well, I'm not a doctor, and I can't promise you that that angioplasty will... I would say dwell in that place if you can. If it is too unpleasant, okay, maybe don't do it. But give it a try if you're able to. Like, only if it's really unpleasant, really psychologically somehow, I don't know, difficult or harsh or... but if it isn't psychologically hard, yeah, well then just know that place. It's okay. It might not feel how you would like, but just dwell there anyway. The win here is that you can feel it at all.
I'm feeling it.
Yeah, okay, so that's very good. I had the hardest time feeling anything in there. It was just blank.
I can feel it. So, I mean, I wish I can overcome it. I mean, I wish that I could have...
Okay, well, just be patient, sister. You know, that might stay there for quite a long time. That might stay for days, months, years, I don't know. But I say you've done your duty as a meditator. As long as you know that you can feel it, okay? The fact that you have sensitivity at all is the win, as opposed to it being just numb and you can't feel it at all. Yeah, so that's an important distinction here. It's like we're not looking to control. We're not looking to force. And it won't help if we bring our expectations that it should be something different. Because that's desire, actually. That's wanting something. I want it to be different. I want it to feel this way or that way, or I want it to be gone, or whatever. I say, just sensitivity at all is all that is this technique would recommend. Just sensitivity at all, and then be patient. That sensation you just explained could be there for quite a while. I don't know. I've personally had to put a lot of effort into being able to feel that place myself, and it was really worth it once I finally could feel what was there. And the exercise here, it's like acceptance. Accept that that's how it is right now. And just make peace with that's how it is right now. It'll change when it's ready. Just trust the Dhamma. Trust the process, and we'll see what happens. Like, by the end of the retreat, maybe it'll be different. Sometimes these things that come up, they can last for days. Sometimes it takes a lot of tolerance, a lot of patience, to just kind of let those things... It's almost like they process themselves. And our job is to just be sensitive enough to know that it is there. And these things usually will sort themselves out. Like, it's not us who's sorting it out. It's like the Dhamma sorts it out. And we just bring a mindfulness to this process. Just awareness itself has a purifying quality. And then the problem just kind of sorts itself out almost all the time. So many times that's worked for me. I've gained tremendous faith that this that this Dhamma sorts these things out. Maybe not every problem in my life, but most of them. It is a safe default to assume. And it is tremendously efficient to let that work itself out. And then, okay, whatever few problems remain, now it's much easier to deal with those. You know what I mean? There were like 10 problems that I didn't have to solve because they solved themselves. And now there's only 2 or 3 problems left. And now it's much more manageable to just work on those 2 or 3. You see? So there's a tremendous efficiency to that. I know it feels frustrating because we wish we could have results faster. But sometimes the Dhamma needs time. It needs to be trusted. Okay? Okay, question? So the question is, should we be imagining our heart when we try to feel that area? I would answer by saying, if the mind is very unsettled and one needs to use some imagining or maybe just some gentle, you know, inner voice, you know, oh, may my heart be at peace, may my heart be at ease, or, you know, may my heart you know, may I be able to feel my heart, or whatever. Sometimes some of that inner dialogue is good, or imagining is good, but just as a means to establish that mindfulness better, the Buddha would call this investigation of Dhamma, or Dhamma Vicaya, investigation, where we actively use our mind, we actively use thinking or maybe imagining, but in the longer term, we don't really want to do imagining, no. It's more like a direct experience. It is a direct sensing. We are hoping to just get to the direct sensory input. You know what I mean? The direct information from our senses. Without any thinking about it, without any visualizing, without any imagining. So some investigation of Dhamma can be good at the start. You know, use it as necessary. But then once you begin to settle better and you feel peaceful, then let that, try to drop that imagining. This is not about visualizing or imagining. It's about, like, where is your heart? Where's the location? Can you feel it? So that is very much mindfulness of the body. Okay? Okay, question? Okay, there's a question about burping. Well, I think that we can have a gentle intention, a gentle suggestion, you know, may the body calm down and not need to burp. May there be a relaxing of this body, you know what I mean? This kind of a gentle suggestion is like I'm being careful here to frame it like these are gentle suggestions we give ourselves, but we can't really force anything. We can't really control anything. Like we can't say, okay, body, stop doing that, because that probably won't work. Sometimes I get the hiccups, and they just stop when they're ready to stop. It's, you know, it's not something I can just directly control. I would suggest maybe go try walking meditation. Maybe a change in your body position might help it. And another thought too is like, is there any food or drink which you might suspect causes it? Maybe there's a particular food that you, it's not suitable for you or something that may cause it. I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but sometimes these sorts of issues come from some sort of a food allergy or a sensitivity or something like this. Okay, so the question is, if one cries when you part ways with good friends, like who are yogis who meditate, is that crying a bad thing or a good thing?
It's a good thing.
Because she got feedback that, you know, she shouldn't be crying.
We left together.
Yeah, well,
she didn't cry, but I cried.
Well, there is, I think, some cultural context there. You know, like myself, I grew up in a family where my father and my uncles, they had sort of this tough guy kind of a cultural thing where, you know, none of them would cry, even if they got hurt. And it would be very embarrassing if they were ever caught crying, you know. It'd be very unmanly if they ever cried. Now, women would cry if there was something to cry about. The women would cry a lot more easily. I think there's some cultural dimension to this. And I guess I can't say I know you and your friends well enough to know that. But how can I put this? Like, sometimes there is a type of crying that's almost good to do because it can release some sort of a pent-up emotions, and then you feel better for it. But then there's sort of like the type of crying the Buddha would have us avoid, which is like the really, really like deep grief kind of a crying. Let's say a close loved one died, and now one is in this very deep grief, maybe for days, weeks, and there's, you know, just lost in crying and lost in pain and, you know, just overcome and just completely an emotional wreck, you know. So that is what the Buddha is warning us about, is being that kind of an emotional wreck when these difficult things in our life happen. At the time of the Buddha, they had a cultural thing where whenever a father of a family would die, the son was expected to go through this kind of like grieving process. He would go to the graveyard, like to the charnel ground, and it was almost like a public display of how much grief he has because he loved his dad so much. And they would like beat their breasts. He would like beat his chest with his fist and scream at the sky, like, no! Like, he's just like, ah, you know, totally making a big scene, right? And this was expected. Like, if you were a good son, you better do that. You need to show the world how much you loved your dad. Like, you're just crushed by this. You're just, like, devastated. You know what I mean? If you didn't do this, you were a bad son. You must have not loved your dad, you know? So this kind of thing can be very cultural. Like when my grandfather died, a lot of people went to the funeral. There must have been like 200 people at his funeral. It was a big funeral. And, you know, a lot of people really liked him. He was a respected man. But there was like one person who cried. I mean, one person in 200 cried. But that's just how my family was. It was, he came from a British background, and the British have this cultural thing. They call it the stiff upper lip. The stiff upper lip, meaning like face, you know, difficult emotional things like you're made of stone. You know what I mean? Like you're just, just don't show the emotion at all. So they repress their emotions probably more than they should. It's kind of the opposite of this Indian thing I just mentioned, with the beating the chest and screaming and making a big thing, you know. So so I can't really answer your question other than to say sometimes there's a good kind of crying where you will feel better afterwards, and it's not that long. And maybe from missing your friends, and you just really love your friends, and you're really going to miss them, you know, that kind of a cry. That's probably a good kind of cry. And that, I would say, is different than what the Buddha is warning us about, which is this, you know, lost in grief for days, and, you know. Like, I remember once when I was a layperson, I had a girlfriend that I was very, very attached to. And then when the relationship kind of fell apart, I was just totally destroyed for like 3 days. I just laid in my bed completely emotionally, like wiped out and sad and depressed and, you know, just completely useless for like 3 days. And that never happened to me before. So, you know what I mean? Like this is to be lost in these emotions. Overcome by them. You know, there was like a grieving process there. You know what I mean? Yeah, so, Anyway, I guess like how fast do we recover from these, you know, big, like, disappointments or traumas or whatever? If we have good emotional resiliency, we do bounce back faster, you know? Maybe we cry for a little bit, but then we bounce back, and then we're happy again. You know what I mean? Yeah, so that's what all this mindfulness and meditation, I say, this builds up this resiliency, where we're not quite so destroyed emotionally, and we bounce back faster. I don't think the Buddha ever goes so far as to say, like, you should just never cry at all, zero, ever. And it's, you know, I don't think he ever goes that far.